Welcome to the Marketing Commute, a podcast that explores the roads taken and the lessons learned for the best and brightest in marketing today. I'm Mike Boyd, and joining me on the commute this time are Andrew Baxter, Senior Advisor at KPMG Australia.
Hi, Mike.
Professor Vince Mitchell, Professor of Marketing at the University of Sydney Business School.
Hi, Mike.
And Carmen Becker, Partner at KPMG Australia and Leader of their CMO Advisory Practice.
Hi, Mike.
In this episode of the Marketing Commute, we are joined in the studio by Stuart Greger. Stuart is a 20-year veteran of the drinks business and around the same vintage in the world of lifestyle, public relations and events. Stuart is a co-founder of Four Pillars Gin and as well as one of Australia's leading PR agencies, Liquid Ideas. So it should be a great chat with Stuart today. We'll also get the latest thoughts and perspectives on marketing trends in Mitchell's Marketing Minute. All right, let's go. Okay, people, what's caught our eye this week?
Well, for me, there's been quite a few stories around the aftermath of the very sad bushfire situation and a lot of the winery industries that were close by to those bushfires, like Adelaide Hills, for example. And they're talking about, you know, smoke taint coming through the grapes. And I think there's going to be quite a challenge for marketers how to overcome that sort of thing when, you know, if that becomes a perception that this year's wine production from a certain region isn't going to be as good a wine as it has been in the past. And there's other wine regions just because of the drought that are really low on, other than the bushfires, very low on yield. So I think it's going to be quite an interesting time for winemakers in marketing.
One of the things I've noticed is on a recent trip to London, the rise of the non-alcoholic alcohol. So like the no meat meat, corn or the like, a vegan sort of hamburger, we're seeing this brands coming into this space with rapid attention. One of the examples I had was Seed Lip, which I'm not sure if anyone's tried it, but it's tastes exactly like gin. It's sold in the soft drink aisle. It's around $50 a bottle. In London, I saw it in a shop called Holland & Barrett, which is a health food store, and it was in a miniature format, like you buy a mini vodka or might at the airport, or you might have a mini in a mini bar. And it was in a miniature. It was £3.99, and you could get it on sale for £1 to try it, and they were selling it as a miniature.
And so in a blind test, you couldn't tell the difference.
Wow, a blind test, I'm sure you could tell the difference.
As in your eyes covered, not when you've had a few.
Yeah, I've never done a blind test. Not a bad idea. We should bring that into the studio one day and see what happens. It smells like gin, yeah, and it has a botanical flavour like gin. And in London, what they've done is restaurants and beautiful bars have a Seed Lip menu now. So they are actually selling Seed Lip as a mixer in a cocktail. So anything that has gin in it now has a Seed Lip version.
Wow. From what I heard, they were actually promoting it like an alcohol too, like in all of the ways they were doing sampling and all those sorts of things that you traditionally have for a launch of a new alcohol brand, which is interesting given that it's non-alcoholic, but it's getting people into that mindset.
But is that then driven, I wonder how much the price point plays into that?
Yeah, I mean, in Australia, $50 for a sort of infused botanical water is quite a lot of money, but there's something about it that's selling really, really well. We're seeing huge growth in the category.
I really quite like the potential placebo effect that this has, right? Yeah. So part of, particularly in the giddy part of getting, you're kind of drunk and you're at a party and it's all kind of, you're chatting to kind of, it's all kind of excitement and you're having a drink and you think, oh my God, this is, you're kind of great. Yeah, you get a high on the atmosphere, not on the alcohol. Yeah, so actually, if you're ever having a gin-like drink, I'm not sure your experience is going to be any different. Now, after the third or fourth gin-like drink, you might begin to see the difference between yours and kind of, yeah.
You can still drive home, and they can't.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and there are some of the advantages. Yeah. But potentially, I like that kind of placebo. That actually, as long as it feels, smells like, and things like the fact that I'm getting high on other things, I probably think that's a good thing.
I did see that there was a couple of Australian brands starting to come out in this space too. There was one called Altered, ALTD, I think, that had come out. So I think we're going to see more of this. It goes right back to, you know, I remember growing up and, parents and friends, when they wanted to, what was it called? Clayton's.
Clayton's.
The drink you had when you don't have a drink. Now, I've known our next guest, Stuart Greger, for quite a few years from the advertising and PR industry. He began his career as a journalist back at News Limited in the late 80s, and then he moved across to Foster's, where he worked in communications there. And after that, he set up a great PR agency called Liquid Ideas. But nowadays, he's most well known for being one of the co-founders of Four Pillars Gin. He's also the president of the Australian Distillers Association, and he's been on the board of Oz Harvest for the past 9 years and just come off that after a great stint there. So we're really looking forward to hearing the story behind Stu and his career, as well as the great story of Four Pillars Gin. Welcome to the Marketing Commute.
Thanks for having me, Billy. Fun. This was good. I love talking about myself.
That's right. Everyone does. So you founded Liquid Ideas in 2000, and then, 13 years you'd had enough and thought, I'm going to go and make some gin.
it's a funny thing for those people in marketing and comms and running their own agency. So, in fact, interestingly, so Liquid Ideas was actually founded 20 years ago in February. So it was actually, it's 20 years old. We founded it in February 2020. And we're actually having 20th anniversary celebrations this year because I still am the sole shareholder of it. We've got a CEO in there, and it's a really great agency. But it started in that whole PR world, I suppose, where in the olden days you used to be pitching stories to newspapers and magazines and television reporters and all that sort of stuff. Very much changed into content and influencer engagement and social media, digital. It's been a really interesting ride. But I guess, I did it for about, I always had my background. I'd come out of college. I'd been to the University of Adelaide down at Roseworthy, studying wine back in the 90s and in the early 90s. And so wine had always been in the blood, and I'd lived in France for a while. So I was trying to combine this whole idea of doing running a wine PR business, but always on the side I was writing about wine. So I used to write columns for the Sunday papers in Sydney and Melbourne for like 10 years, and I wrote a lot of books and judged a lot of wine shows and made a bit of wine with a guy who turned out to be not just a pretty good at wine, but he turned out to be a pretty good distiller. And he's actually the guy that I founded Four Pillars with, a guy called Cameron McKenzie, who's an interesting story on his own, as Billy knows, because he's an ex-Olympic athlete. So he ran for Australia in 96 in the Atlanta Olympics. Then he tried to make the 2000 Olympics, where he came to work for me when I was, as Billy said, when I was at Foster's at the time at Mildara Blass, which is now Treasury Wine. So it's that giant, it's the biggest wine business in Australia. And he came to me on an Olympic scholarship, you know, to train to make the Olympics. But the first day he came to work for me, I took him straight out to lunch because that's what I was good at. He missed his first training session of his career and missed out on the Olympics by less than a tenth of a second from the 2000 Olympics. So I felt indebted to him forever. I feel so apologetic. I built him a distillery,
right,
as a giant edifice, like a giant apology. And
has he forgiven you?
Well, he's a much better. I tell people that he's a much better distiller than he ever was as an athlete.
Right. Okay.
Right? He's won more gold medals and international recognition as a distiller than he ever did as a sort of mid-ranking Australian 400-meter runner who was lucky to make the relay.
Right. Fair enough.
So I don't know if that even remotely answers the question. But,
no.
But
it does.
We had this period in about the 2010s where I thought, well, I want to make. We wanted to do something other than wine. Wine is really, really difficult. You know, talk about a fragmented market, too many brands. Climate, I mention it, is a bit challenging for wine right now. And even 2020, this year, Australian wine has had probably the toughest vintage in my living memory, with smoke, bushfires, then all of a sudden you get floods.
Yeah,
and if you think you've survived the bushfires and if you've survived the drought and all the heat, then you cop a flood right in the middle of vintage. So it's incredibly impossible. So we thought, we drank gin. We drank a lot of gin, Cam and I, and we thought, well, why wouldn't we make gin? There wasn't much gin being made in Australia in 2013. Yeah. And interestingly, no one was calling out for it. There wasn't this latent. People weren't walking into a bar going, if only there was an Australian gin,
yes. That's
what I'd be ordering. Said no one ever.
Yeah.
So we.
So did anyone think you were mad?
Yeah, right. Most people thought we were mad, but we found 20 people who didn't think we were mad.
Right.
And they were our original investors. I got a few of them drunk before they invested. Three of them came in on Melbourne Cup Day. So if anyone's out there looking for investors for a slightly dubious, particularly alcohol-focused entrepreneurial undertaking, Cup Day. People say some funny things on Cup Day, and if you hold it to them, go, hey, by the way, mate, you promised me you'd invest in my gin distillery at 4:30 yesterday, and here's the...
Paperwork.
Here's the IM, the paperwork, and the BSB details.
Yeah. So back then, 2013, there would have been less than 20 gin distillers in Australia, right, and now there's nearly a couple of hundred.
Yeah, there is. There's a couple of hundred now. Back then, there would have been less than five.
Right.
You know, there would have been basically the industry was Tasmanian whiskey. So, yep. So a guy called Bill Lark started up the Tasmanian whiskey industry sort of in the early 90s, late 80s. There were a couple of people making gin. There was a West Winds, you know, down in Western Australia. There was a little one in Kangaroo Island and not much else. And so when we came on the market, it was the end of 2013. And I think we were lucky that we came, I don't know whether it was luck or good management, but we came right at the start of the wave. And now, as you say, there's probably, we think, about 180 distilleries making gin in Australia now. And for that to have come from 5 or 10 6 years ago, it's incredible.
In a way, though, Four Pillars has stood the test of time through its, I mean, its marketing, its branding.
It's good to stand the test of time over 6 years.
Yeah, 6 years. But that's a huge amount of brands to come onto the market so quickly. And you've obviously had a big background in wine, as you said, which is a very saturated market. But what do you think from a marketing point of view? What held you in that good stead when all that competition flushed into the market?
There's a couple of things that stood us in good stead. One is that we had a lot of experience in the industry itself, right? So Cam and I both came out of 15, 20 years in the industry. So we knew the retailers, we knew the publicans, we knew the bar guys, we knew the key influencers in the domestic industry. And we also knew how to produce booze and sell booze. One of the things I worry about a lot of these new gin brands is they're coming out of, you know, they might have run a news agency or they might have been a banker or they might have, you know, just come out, heaven forbid, come out of advertising, even worse. And they don't have any real understanding of how the industry itself works. And then the other thing is we got a guy called Matt Jones into the business. And so Matt was a creative strategy guy, right? So he came out of Jack Morton, where he was the global head of strategy in Manhattan, in New York, you know, New York, running the world. And he married, thank God, he married an Australian girl whose dad is a very famous wine guy, a guy called Peter Bourne. And Rebecca and Matt decided to move back to Australia. Matt was looking for a job, and I just lucked upon him. And he, from a strategic point of view, he has helped us build the brand, but also keep the brand on track and in focus, and keep us doing great things all the time. You know, everything we do, from the production, from the hospitality, through to the design, through to the digital, is outstanding. You know, it's got to be best of class, everything you do. You know, you talk about all your P's. It's not good enough to do three or four of them well and a couple of them a bit shit. You've got to be incredible at all of them. And I think one of the big advantages Four Pillars has had is when we do creative stuff, it's always the best. When we do events, they're always the best. When we build a distillery, rather than a crappy shed out of the back, you know, we started in a crappy shed out of the back of a mate's winery, but we soon knew that we needed to have a hospitality experience that was world-class, not just all right. And then the gin, you know, and at the end of the day, we could do all of those things right, but if we weren't making world's best gin, because as I said, no one wanted Australian gin, so if we weren't making some of the world's best gins, we wouldn't get a look in anywhere around the world. And we're in 30-plus markets now. And we had to have we wanted a portfolio of gins, each of which was the best of its class in the world. And to win that big award in November last year, which is the Oscar, if you like, of the Australia of the international spirits world, that said that, you know, we're doing it as well as anyone in the world. Like we are the best international gin distillery of 2019, and that's pretty cool. We never would have imagined we could do that. And it wasn't just for one product, it was for the suite of products, which I think is really important.
And just to remind our listeners, this is a marketing podcast, not an alcohol gin podcast.
Oh, yeah, totally.
But who did you see off in that award at the end of last year? I'm curious.
I mean, everyone. So it is for any gin distiller. So you're talking literally thousands who entered the IWSC. So some very small gin distilleries won't. They exclude the United Kingdom because the UK has its own award because there's, I mean, if anyone's been to the United Kingdom recently, you'll know that there's a gin distillery literally on every street corner. Every village has one. So there are as many gin distilleries in the United Kingdom as there are in the rest of the world combined.
Right.
And everyone who enters. And I mean, it's the biggest. There's more than well over 5,000 distilleries enter the IWSC. And it's a 50-year-long competition. So it's pretty good. And, you know, from a marketing perspective, it's interesting to win those awards because it's not enough just to win that award. You get a good kick in the old days. I mean, one of the great advantages I think we have from a publicity point of view is that, you know, we do have this PR machine behind us, this little PR business on the side. So if we do win an award, we can really ramp it up quickly. And we know the mechanics because having done the PR for a bunch of different businesses that have won these types of awards before, you know, you're only as good as the attention you draw to it in that, I'll call it 72-hour period, 96-hour, you know, 3 to 5 days afterwards. You know, you need to own social media, you need to own old media, you know. You want to get stories in the newspaper and you want to be on telly and you need to be on radio and you need to get interviews. And it helps us a great deal that we have – me with 20 years of that experience, and also I suppose as a client of my own PR company, I do have the ability, if we do win an award like that, to get all the good account managers very quickly onto my account. I'll just take that. Of course, none of the other clients of Liquid Ideas need to know that. So as long as they're not listening to this, we're good.
And you said earlier you're in 30 markets already. And so can you give us an example of any of those markets that have really surprised you as you've been launching afresh?
Well, I suppose the one that surprises me the most is the UK, simply because it's Coles to Newcastle. Like, the concept of selling gin to the Poms is hilarious.
Yeah.
We've had a few rocky starts. I mean, one of the difficult things in any market is that you have to appoint a distributor who is not you, you know, so you have to appoint a local business, you know, whether that's in Singapore or Japan or even the UK, who represents you in the marketplace. So it's always a bit, I'm never quite happy with it. But the UK, I think, is fun. We have this product called Bloody Shiraz Gin, which the Poms have just gone for, right? I think they like the Australianness of it. They like the fact it's purple and not clear. It's a little bit sweet. It's kind of stronger than their slow gin, which is kind of was modelled on. And they love it. I mean, that's our number one SKU going into the UK now. And I guess the other one where we've had really great success is Japan. I mean, yeah. I mean, I love going to Japan. Skiing, you know, rugby trips, all that sort of stuff. So Japan, they've loved it. I think they love the precision. They love the we're actually about to launch in a few weeks, a collaboration with the distillery that won the best international gin distillery of the year last year, which is in Kyoto, who make the most exquisite gin, you know, using lots of botanicals and Japanese teas and all this sort of stuff. They're just superb. So we're about to launch a collab gin with them, because in Japan we've got a really strong following.
And when you go into these markets, are you putting people on the ground at all, or are you just choosing your distributor and relying on them for your marketing locally?
It's the greatest challenge. So the first thing I think about export marketing is there's no such thing. That's a fallacy, first of all. You have to go market by market, because no two markets are the same, particularly in alcohol, where there are legislative differences in every country that just do your head in. Like America, as an example, is the most complicated of all of them. You know, our American distributor last week explained to me what a dry tasting was in store in California. So a dry tasting is no tasting at all. it's someone standing in the store saying, if you were to taste this gin, it would be fantastic and it would taste like this or this. But you can't give them the little. I didn't even get to whether you can smell it, but you can't taste it. That's one particular law in liquor stores in California that isn't the same law as in liquor stores in New York, as an example.
Right.
So we've got three guys. Yeah, these are things. and don't get dry me on tasting. some of the southern states have really crazy laws. Texas has got particularly difficult laws. We still can't sell our gin in Texas. We can't get our heads around the distribution structure in Texas. We've got a guy on the ground in Singapore who services Asia. We've got a guy on the ground in San Francisco who services the United States. And we've got a full-time guy on the ground in the UK servicing sort of the UK and Europe. Two of them are Aussies, and one of them is a Pom who's worked in Australia for a long time. And, you know, it's an interesting thing, because we do notice that they love to hear an Aussie accent come in and sell an Aussie gin. It is a bit of a unique, a bit of a USP for us. So we're going to have to get rid of the guy from Burnley who sells our gin in the UK. Even the Poms don't like hearing a Burnley accent when they walk into a bar.
And then your agency relationship obviously is global, because, you know, you've got a good connection into the lead CEO of the agency. So, but do they help you with your international needs as well?
The PR agency?
Yeah, PR.
Yeah. Oh, look.
Do you do that all out of Australia?
We do most of it out of Australia. We have actually appointed, we originally appointed, and again, it's an interesting thing for anyone who's thinking about taking a product into market. Because of my background in public relations, I suppose, one of the first things I did both in the UK and the US was appoint a PR agency to launch the product, if you like, which is great. And we got some terrific publicity, and we had some great parties, and, you know, a few interesting people came along, but we had no distribution. So anyone who might have read that article, whether it wasn't in the New York Times, but were to be in the New York Times, was probably in the, you know, some online publication in New York, they couldn't find it. So what I realized is that we went too early with the PR, and we should have spent probably 2 years getting the distribution right, just getting into the trade, getting the channels filled, and then gone to the PR. Because, you know, in the UK, we did exactly the same thing, because you don't learn from your mistakes, obviously. and we had terrific publicity, but no distribution.
So, don't distributors sometimes go, unless you're popular, we're not going to you know, isn't it a bit of
chicken and egg. Chicken and it egg. Is a little bit. And it may, I would like to think in my mind, I love what you're saying there. It may have helped us gain distribution.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure it did. I think we needed to work harder on one of the things you do learn when you own your own brand rather than consult to other people's brands is that it all comes down to sales. You know, I mean, I'm a PR guy and I'll talk marketing bullshit forever. But seriously, at the end of the day, if we can't get through that channel and get into Waitrose, we've still been trying to get into a supermarket in the UK, for instance, for 4 years now. And the publicity machine is no good unless people in the regions can get hold of it, particularly with the amorphous nature of social media now, which means that everyone's reading about it. And if they read about it but can't access it easily, like they need to be able to walk down to their store and buy it. It's earned you nothing. Someone can tell you that it's had 180 million page impressions, or it's got some fatuous value, marketing value or advertising value equivalent or anything else. It means nothing if someone can't buy the product. Zero. So I really want to work that distribution piece out. We're slowly working it out. Maybe we've got it right in New Zealand.
Third time's a charm.
Just on your distribution, your piece there, I did an analysis of 30 years of the Marketing Society Awards in the UK. Yeah, and we looked at where we could identify the P's of the marketing mix.
Yep.
Yeah, and what the ROI was when you invest in each one of those. And we found the distribution place was by far, you had the greatest return on ROI, which just backs up what you're saying there, that if however much you spend on all of the other P's, if people can't find it in place to buy, then...
Well, two things. One is you've got to find the right places. You know, you are. I used to say you are where you are, right? So if we're in the best bars, so one of our strategies that really did work for us in Australia was that, I mean, we were lucky because I knew a lot of restaurateurs and really the top end of town from doing a lot of food and wine stuff over the years. Is I wanted to be able to be in that martini if you went to Key or to Rockpool or to any of those sort of really high end places in Australia. That's a good place to start. And then you have to be in the better bars where people are going to go for serious cocktails, and then you sort of trickle down from there. But equally, you can't survive as a liquor brand with growth. So you can survive if all you want to be is a little small regional brand in South Gippsland and just servicing your local community. You can't if you're not in Dan Murphy's. I mean, they sell 30%+ of all booze in Australia goes through that one place. So, we were unashamed. A lot of liquor brands get afraid. Oh my God, I can't be in Dan Murphy's. They're going to discount me. And that's just, first of all, they've been the greatest supporter of gin. If you walk into a Dan Murphy's, it's astonishing the number of Australian gins that you see. It's like, it blows my mind. I hate it because you lose facings all the time to another Aussie gin brand. But you really do have to get that distribution right. But you've also got to make sure then, and this is one of the issues that a lot of these smaller distilleries have, you've got to get depletions. You've got to get people coming in and buying that stuff off the shelves. And that's where award wins and PR and Instagram and social media and Facebook and events and tastings, these things just absolutely reinforce distribution, while saying you get distribution, but having your channel management, right, so they don't sell out. We were sold out so often in Dan Murphy's in our first couple of years because we just couldn't get our projections right. And they thought, oh, well, it's an Aussie gin and we'll only sell 4 bottles of that a month in this particular Dan Murphy's. So it took us a good year and a half for them and us to get a bit of a balance to figure out how much stock they should have in a shop. Because I hate people go, some people think it's great to sell out on a shelf and I loathe it. Because every person who walks up and sees an empty row of 4 pillars is going to buy a bottle of Hendrix.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And they're going to have, and that could be 3 months before they come back.
Yeah.
So I just, and people, oh, you must be so popular. You're selling out all the, I can never find you on the shelf. And I go, oh.
Now, you had an interest in a wine business before this.
I did. Thank you for reminding me.
But what did you learn from that going into this success?
Oh, how good gin would be, I think. And also how hard distribution is, because any distribution, so we were, let's say we were one of 5 or one of 10, super premium gins on the market when we launched. We were one of 3,000 wines, and all with 80 to 90% of Aussie wine is really good, right? And cool climate Pinot. Oh, wow, we made a really excellent cool climate Pinot from South Gippsland. So does everyone else. But it might be Tasmania or the Mornington Peninsula or the Yarra, or it might be southern Western Australia or the Adelaide Hills. I mean, there's a million of them that are great. And wine lists are huge, and they're always changing. Whereas if people decide that they like Four Pillars Gin, we'll often stay on that list for years. So I think I learned the importance of distribution. I learned the importance of focus as well. One of the things that I would always suggest to anyone who wants to start up a brand, because every person in marketing and advertising has this dream of, I'm going to set up this great brand on the side and it's going to become Four Pillars Gin, or it's going to become some other, is you've got to quickly make a decision of whether you're committed to it or not. Doing anything half-assed, half-hearted, half-baked, it's obvious to the average consumer. It's obvious to the trade. You know, if it's just and I realized that I thought I could get away with running both the businesses, but within 12 months, I realized I had to pick one or the other, and I was always going to pick booze. you have to go all in. Like, you can't go in a bit half-hearted because it's so competitive. If people see you execute something and it's just a bit shit, why would they come back? There's too much good stuff out there.
Look, I've got to try and squeeze in whatever I can, some academicness to this. And I cannot
miss... I got a marketing degree.
Well done. So you'll understand the importance. Thank you.
From that terrible school in Melbourne. Anyway, it's not as good as this one.
Thank you for that. And this is because there's an article here from the Journal of Consumer Research, which we'll post online, and it's about liquid consumption. So part of your original setup of your PR business, and then your consequent movement into consuming liquids, What this talks about is this phenomenon of liquid consumption. You're coming about in the last kind of 10, 15, 20 years, which is a move from ownership based, material enduring, to more access based, dematerialized, ephemeral, which is actually part of what you're doing now, because actually the gin that you're providing is actually part of an experience. You take away the experience of that, and of course you can create some of that experience, which is the ephemeral. But it's about what people do with the gin as a consequence of tasting and being around people and what you're doing with that. So do you have any kind of comments on that shift in consumer behaviour to the ephemeral and liquid part?
There's a couple of things that I would say. One is we've built this brand on experiences. And I think that's one thing that a lot of brands don't understand, that we have done more events, more experiences, more activations, more chances of meeting people and telling them the story. Because I think as much as anything, as we're storytellers at Four Pillars, you know, we always tell great stories because that's how you can build in. We're only, Billy says we've got a great tradition. We're only 6 years old. Tanqueray is 160 years old. They've got generations of stories and great heritage. We don't have any of that piece. So for us, we have to tell modern stories, stories of today, stories of now, stories of, doing it when no one thought you could. But experiences are everything. One of the things that we knew we had to do as soon as we started was build a home. And a lot of liquor brands didn't have homes. Particularly, they often did in wine, but they didn't do in spirits. And what's happening now is a lot of brands are building homes retrospectively. For instance, Bombay Sapphire never had a home. It was made in a giant factory off the Thames, and now it's got this beautiful home with all these botanicals growing in a gorgeous glass house and everything else. So I think we need people to come and experience what Four Pillars is, because you're right. If they don't have we talk about creating bias. We talk about, we need people to be biased towards Four Pillars like they would be biased towards their football team, that they have, they become not just, brand advocates or whatever, but, apostles almost in that they want to go out there and tell everyone why you have to drink Four Pillars, because essentially it's delicious gin, but it's not entirely unreplaceable by other potentially slightly less delicious gins at a significant discount. So, you have to have the story. That's why we love collaboration. One of the things that I think we've done from a brand point of view is the very few brands in our category have done is we love making gins with other people and sharing our real estate with distilleries that we love. So if that helps in any way, I think that's one thing. And the other thing that people are much more interested in drinking right now is they care, and this is a macro trend across food and drink, is they care what they're putting into their mouth a lot more than they did a decade ago. When I was in the wine industry in the 1990s, we didn't, you want to add tannin, you want to add shit, you want to put in extra acid, you want to do all that sort of stuff, no problems at all. Now people are much more interested in where did the botanicals come from, how sustainable are you? These things are just taken, you've really got to be great at all of that stuff. And they really care that the product is something better than just an industrially distilled you know, bottle of fire water.
And just on that, because part of how you built the DNA out, and I don't know if it was deliberate or not, but you had, you know, obviously Australian Botanicals as part of that, but you also, you know, named the stills. You know, there's a whole story. I mean, maybe just that storytelling was really interesting because it's got a true DNA behind the brand.
Well, we had to create something. So one of the things that we wanted to do is you know, we create, so the story is that we named all of our stills after our mums because it was we found that there was a bit of a tradition to name a still after, you know, a female name, and we said, well, the most important people in all of our lives are our mums, and my mum is a fearsome gin drinker, as was Cameron's, so we thought, well, that makes a lot of sense, but it also allows a story, but it also gives you that lovely, people love that. Oh, you name the stills after your mums. Oh, and it wasn't really, it wasn't part of a, you know, a whiteboard strategy session. Oh my gosh, what are we going to do? It just felt like the right thing to do. Cam's mum got the first still. My mum then got a second still, which was slightly larger than Cam's mum, as she makes that point. And it does, it gives, one of the other things I think you need to do, that we do from a brand, is you want to give other people, you know, sometimes we talk about this sort of dark storytelling where people that you don't know tell stories about your brand to other people you don't know. And that's when you really know that you're entering some, you've got some sort of strength in brand. And we love to give people that, give them the ability, if you like, to tell stories about Four Pillars. When I went to Four Pillars or I tasted them, we do so much activity where we get the chance to tell people stories. I think that's one of our big competitive advantages, and we do it as well as much digitally, because you can't hand to hand combat, whilst great, is not possible. So we do it digitally really well as well, I think. So it's important to not do what everyone else in the category does as well. I think that's super important.
Well, I was going to ask about your career, and the journey you've taken. Do you have any mentors, for that? Yeah, and if you did, who were they, and what did they say?
It's interesting. I don't know. I don't know. Probably the answer is immediately no, because no one's coming to the top of mind as being someone that I used to have fortnightly coffees with who would give me great advice about how to run a business or anything like that. And that's what I imagine a mentor to be. I had people who backed me, and I had people who certainly gave me lots of advice. I take a lot of learning out of other areas. I'm a bit like Billy. I'm obsessed with sport. And I think that's why Cameron and I get on really well. You know, him being an elite athlete, like, he understands the discipline that's required from a sportsman, getting up every day and doing it again. And one of the things that I always said, you know, when people ask what's the key to the success, I just say it's relentlessness. If you don't understand the relentless nature of your own of running your own business and building your own brand, then it's not for you. It's that sportsman's ability to get up every day. And I love listening to football coaches. I love listening to some of the stories that come out of all manner of sports. I'm actually an old-fashioned marketing guy, in that the number of times I stand up on a board and I write down the P's, and like we really attack what we're doing well and where the gaps are in our business. I do a lot of that with a lot of our with both the PR people, the Four Pillars people. You know, I've got a little travel business up in Noosa that, you know, we try to do the same thing. Like, where are we missing out on the basic 7 P's as we're working on now? I really believe in that. I really believe in this as a former PR person. It's all about curiosity. Like, one of the things that I can't handle is, and I actually had my senior guys in my office just this week telling them about being much more curious, like, what's going on out there in all other industries and all other parts of the world. Like, Matt reads a lot of books and theory, and like, he's amazing at the sort of semi-academic side of these things. Like, he can quote you Seth Godin, and he can quote what Ritson or those clowns are all talking about off the well, not a clown, obviously, very intelligent man, blah, blah. he can tell you all of that sort of stuff. Whereas I'm more likely to quote Wayne Bennett than I am. No, I'm more likely to quote Seth Rogen than Seth Godin, I think, is probably, you know. I'll quote Superbad. You know, what I learnt the other day from McLovin? Anyway, but I just just this importance of doing things and doing it really well. Like, I talk about it, you know, you've got two options. You've got an option of doing something really great or doing something a bit crap. Like, that's in everything in life, you know. There's, you can cut the corners, but you don't, you know, there's no shortcuts. I guess See, that sounds like a football coach, doesn't it? What a cliche.
Terrible.
I'm interested in one of the P's, your pricing strategy, because you must have very early on decided to go quite
high.
Yeah.
Go high or go home.
Yeah. And that created a sort of, I guess, a new level in Australia in gin pricing from a local point of view. How did you make that decision?
Well, one of the things that we did, tax, first of all.
Yes.
It's possible that some of that our research into the tax structure was not robust when we started Four Pillars. So I don't think I realised quite how much we pay. So we pay the highest level of excise for a regular bottle of spirits of any Western country. Like it's 10 times more than it is in the US. So first of all, that's why we're $75 a bottle. And that a bottle of gin, just to give you an idea of pricing and how crazy it is, a bottle of gin that sells for $75 Australian at the distillery where it's made, like so probably not more than 15 metres from its place point of production, is $75 for a 700ml bottle. That exact same bottle of gin in a 750ml bottle, it's a little bit extra, is $31.99 right now in San Francisco in US dollars. So I'm going to call that
$45. Wow.
Right? At $75 in Australia. And that the difference in that is just tax. So that's one of the reasons why we said, because I think pragmatic pricing rather than necessarily pricing by market. But we wanted, it was important for us that everyone knew that this was a premium product. And we don't have the economies of scale of Tanqueray or Bombay Sapphire or Hendrix or anyone else like that. We're not making 10 million cases a year. And we wanted to make sure that people realised this was a premium product. And therefore, I think one of the things that you can do, once you set your pricing, reasonably high level. So our gins sort of start at $75 and go up to $100, is that you've got to offer people a premium experience. So every time they come into the distillery, they can't have sloppy service. Every time they see us at a function, they can't get a shit gin and tonic that's made with, you know, crappy ice and bad tonic. That they can't have, you know, if we're going to make marmalade from the leftover oranges from the distillation, it's got to be world-class marmalade. Like people are looking, when people, you know what it's like in any category, if you've spent top dollar on something, you're much more pernickety about its quality. You know, you're looking at flaw, you're looking for flaws. Mm. So we had to make people go, you know what, it might be $75, but crikey, it's good.
And that's how you're making the decisions around your brand extensions?
Yeah, look, there's a little less marketing science and a little bit of, well, there was a Rugby World Cup in Japan, so why don't we make a gin in Japan? There was a little bit of that, but yeah, there's some interestingly our last two collabs. So were with Hernö, who was the International Gin Producer of the Year in 2017, which is a Swedish distillery. So we went up to Sweden, made a gin with them. They came down to Healesville. They made a gin with us in the Yarra Valley, and they are just great people. Everything they do is, you know, their gins are just superb. They're beautiful people. We just love them. And similarly, in Kyoto, when I first came across this gin, it's called Kinobi. There's a little bit of it in Australia. It's very expensive. If you think we've gone premium, they've gone uber premium. And their gins are just exquisite. So we reached out to them. And by us playing in that same sort of field, they were happy to have a chat with us. You know, if we'd been making crappy gin X and we'd approached the world's best gin distiller and said, do you want to do a collab? You know, it'd be like me, you know, it'd be like the busker at Circular Quay ringing Ed Sheeran and saying, hey, man, I want to do a collab with you. Sorry.
Thanks.
You know, so, that's, and everything we do, collateral's got to be great. You know, so, you know, it's, again, if we go back to the basic marketing mix, that if you aren't delivering excellence at every level of it, then you're in strife, I reckon.
So, Stu, is that the future? The collaborations, like what's fast forward 5 years? Where's Four Pillars going to be? Where are you going to be?
I might be here. You know, I'm looking for a bit of tenure at a university. You know, I went to Melbourne and I used to go down every year and lecture the young NYU students who would come across from Stern. I loved it so much because I just love talking. You wouldn't believe that from listening to this dribble. But anyway, for Four Pillars, I think we've got to concentrate on getting our core SKUs great and right. You know, I'm saying that our rare dry gin, which is our gin and tonic gin, which is going to, you know, be 80% of what people drink with our gin, is a gin and tonic. It's got to be next to every, if there's a bottle of Hendrix anywhere in Australia, there's got to be a bottle of Four Pillars right next to it.
Right.
And I think most Australians will make a decision to buy, and if it's relatively similarly priced, because we do a little bit of pricing, you know, we try to align ourselves to products like Hendrick's around the world and a couple of others. Most people buy it. We have never been beaten by Hendrick's in a blind tasting in any competition anywhere in the world. And I don't make that publicly, although I just said it.
Yeah.
We don't put that on collateral because I just don't think any brand needs to draw attention to other brands. That's something that I just think is a silly mistake that quite a few people make. Pepsi. but we need those key gins to be great. Mm. The collaborations are fun because what we have to do is we have to be, now that we're bigger, we have to be everyone's first choice. Everyone in Australia, let's talk about Australia for the moment, everyone's first choice if they're going to go premium with their gin. If they're going to trade up from Bombay or Tanqueray, we want them to come to us first. That means that we're going to have to be more mainstream, if you like. And then our other gins, these collaboration gins, we've got to do stuff that's interesting that no one's done before. Like we're going to make a really interesting savoury martini gin this year that we're going to launch that our American mates are just gung-ho for that no one has done. Like, we launched a gin called a Negroni gin, which was basically just made with one bar to go into a Negroni. And it's become really popular. It's our third most popular gin. And so we thought, well, we should make a gin that if you were going to use it for one drink and one drink only for the rest of your life, it would just make the perfect martini. And we've got some incredible olive groves in Australia. So we want to work with some great olive growers who actually happen to also to be mates of ours and do something with a olivey, briny sort of gin. Yeah, I know, it's going to be unreal. They look fantastic. So the olive harvest is April in Australia, so we're getting ready to make that. The purple gin, I think the Bloody Shiraz gin, like people are, the pink gin thing's a bit of a thing at the moment. You know, everyone's loving an Aperol spritz. Everyone wants a pinky, orangey, light-coloured, gorgeous Instagrammable drink. So even though we've got a deep purple gin, it makes beautiful pink drinks. So I think Bloody Shiraz gin, and it's a unique story. So again, the category said, well, we make slow gin, which is a pretty ordinary, I think, horrible style of English gin where you steep slow berries in with a gin and then you add heaps and heaps of sugar and it's disgusting. Anyway, we decided to steep ours in Shiraz because there's a lot of Shiraz in the Yarra Valley and turn that into an interesting, sweeter style purple that makes gorgeous pink drinks. So I think that'll go great. And then I think we'll probably focus on fewer markets, doing more in each of those markets. One of the, without wanting to go back to our, you know, my lack of export strategy is that I think you get very excited as a small business when someone from some random country rings you up and says they want to import your product. You get thrilled. So I said yes to every one of them to start with. Like for everyone from Malaysia, not a big gin drinking market, through to Taiwan, to France, to everyone. And honestly, after that, we had to then go around and we've sacked every single distributor we originally appointed, except our one in Australia, thank God.
Wow.
Every one of them, from New Zealand to the UK to France to everywhere. So that was my year last year. That's a great joy, traveling around the world, sacking people.
Yeah. undo all your nasty work.
Yeah, so what we've realised is that certain markets, we've got a real strong following, and other markets are relatively ambivalent to it. So the French, for instance, just don't get why Australian gin. They just got no interest at all. So, you know, there's my trips to Paris gone. Oh, except I've got one more trip to sack him. He still owes us money. Anyway.
And then what about this trend towards non-alcoholic gin?
I know. Look, we've got to do something with it. There's two sort of macro trends in drinks are low alcohol and low sugar. And I think we've got to do both of those things. I just think it's difficult for a business built on the craft of making alcohol and making spirits. It's going to be very difficult for us to make a totally non-alcoholic spirit. I totally admire the people who are doing it, you know, and I think that some of the brands in that category are truly brilliant. I think Seedlip's an incredible brand. And Liars, we were just talking about Liars in Australia, it's a great brand coming from nowhere, you know, a year ago. But I think that's an easy that's something that you would do if you were not Four Pillars well established gin distillery. I just think it'd be difficult for us under our umbrella. Not to say that a third party company associated with this couldn't come up with a really clever idea of making. We've tried to make different gins at lower alcohol, sort of so concentrating the flavor in lower alcohol, so you need to use less. But people don't use less. Well, if someone tells you to put 15 mils of a gin in a gin and tonic, even if it's got twice as much flavour as the regular gin, you still pour as much of it. This is one of the problems with giving some of high proof gin. You say, oh, you can use less of it. And like people just look at you going, why would I use less of it? I mean,
because my bar cart's got a single nip thing on it.
I've got one measure at home.
Yeah, exactly, and, you know, right.
The measure doesn't scream at me when it's high proof.
Stop it. And if I turn it over to put the double one in, it doesn't fall out the bottom.
Low sugar. I mean, lower sugar. People are looking for better for you drinks. And I think, look, we can provide the alcohol and a lot of the mixes. It's interesting. There'll be a sugar tax in Australia, you would have thought, in the next 2 or 3 years, mimicking what's happened in the UK. So mixes that are lower in sugar. I'll get in trouble for saying this from my partners, but I'm a big gin and soda fan.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
It's a great drink because you can really taste the gin. And it's just a beautiful drink and lower alcohol, so you can have more of them. Of course, though, we're only promoting responsible service of alcohol.
And we'll just remind our listeners, this is the Marketing Commute.
Well, Stu, that has been an amazing chat. Incredible to hear your story, Four Pillars story. I think all of our listeners, whether they be from students through to the most experienced marketers that tune in, will just be fascinated to have listened to what you've gone through. So thanks for joining us here at the Marketing Commute.
Thanks for having us, team. And let's have a martini.
Done.
So for this week's Your Marketing Minute, I've chosen something that I developed as part of my textbook, and that is to get students to think about themselves as a product. It seems to me that most of our enormously successful marketing gurus we've had on the Marketing Commute have managed their career well. Or to put it another way, they've managed their product well in a competitive job marketplace. Now, whether you've done that consciously, or unconsciously, the fact is that in a service economy, we are all products and we all operate in different marketplaces when we create value for the marketplace of friends, the family marketplace for extended families, the dating market, and of course, the job market. So one of the key features of my book is to take students through this process and learn about the marketing principles whilst applying them to improving the competitiveness of their product in the job market. Essentially, they're going to do a marketing plan for brand you. There are exercises on market research, where we explore how to research employers' needs and what they want. For the product chapter, we look at features and benefits you bring. And for the communications chapter, we look at how best to communicate those features and benefits in your CV, as a piece of direct mail, or in person-to-person selling situation. And of course, in the branding chapter, we look at how to develop your brand essence and a customer value proposition. Now, this doesn't mean that we should all become paranoid about our image or actions, as the authentic self is absolutely important in getting a job. But it does help students, and in fact anyone in the job market, to think more strategically and systematically about making themselves the most attractive they can be to achieve their career goals. So, team, what do you think about the concept of brand you?
Do you remember when we had Ed on the show and he had moved to the UK for personal reasons and didn't know anyone and hadn't got a job yet, really? And what he did was actually think, what don't I know, went round the UK, got to know the UK customer and consumer and what they were thinking. And he used that to get himself a job, because that was basically teaching himself, but also sharing that knowledge built his brand. I think it's absolutely essential.
I think also, just as an extension of that, one of the things I've written on in the past is around using ACCA's framework for brand differentiation, relevance, building brands. And so you've got differentiation, relevance, esteem, knowledge. And if you unpick a lot of sports stars, celebrities, politicians, you can actually see through those sorts of frameworks how they've been both successful. Like one person I wrote about many years ago was Kevin Rudd. When he first came to everybody's knowledge, he was very different. He spoke Mandarin and he was quite relevant, seemed to be of the people, and there was seemed to be that sense of popularity and authenticity about him, and people got to know him quite quickly. But then you went forward a bit, and as people got to understand him a little bit more, then they started to challenge some of those first initiatives, and I suppose his brand just went off the boil a little bit. So I quite like all these, using these different frameworks with people, and I think for the students, it's a product they know well, and I think it's a great exercise to be working them through to understand some of the fundamentals of marketing frameworks.
And do the frameworks, so I'm answering a question with a question, but the frameworks work well with the tools or the myriad of tools that people have today from a social, from a digital point of view? Like there's a new one every other week. Does it grow and adapt with that?
Part of the reason that it's I've brought this on board is because we've never had more opportunity to curate our own brand image now than before. Yeah, because of digital technologies, and the way that those can be used by our student population to brand themselves. So yes, in the communications part, we talk about, how are you going to use this channel to communicate some of your features and benefits which are consistent with how you've defined your brand for the job that you're trying to get. So the short answer is yes. Yeah, it does. And yes, it does in a more effective way than we've ever been able to do. If you'd been doing brand new 30 years ago, it would have been a much more difficult challenge for a student to do. Whereas in the digital world, it's a much easier challenge.
Well, that's it for this episode of The Marketing Commute. Thanks to our guests, Stuart Greger from Four Pillars Gin, to Andrew Baxter and Carmen Becker from KPMG, and to Professor Vince Mitchell from the University of Sydney. To our producers, Boyd Britton and Billy Gleason, the studios here at the University of Sydney Business School, and to KPMG's customer, brand and marketing advisory team. You can find The Marketing Commute in all good podcast networks, and you can read more detailed show notes and get links from each episode and find out more about our guests and presenters at our website, themarketingcommute.com. I'm Mike Boyd. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you at the next stop on The Marketing Commute.
You have reached your destination.